Upfront, inside Atlanta's entertainment industry, is brought to you by Atlanta's Jazz Station, 91.9 FM, WCLK.
Coming up on this week's show, Edward Adams from the African American Film Critics Association, AFCA, is here to discuss this week's Oscar nominations and more. Stephanie Hite from the High Museum of Art is also here to discuss Something Over Something Else, Romare Bearden's Profile series, which is now in its final weeks. And closing out the show is my exclusive with Tyler Perry and the stars of his new Netflix film, A Fall from Grace, Crystal Fox, Felicia Rashad, and Brisha Webb. I'll also be playing music from Roy Hargrove, Erykah Badu, and Incognito. But first, here's a word from our underwriters.
Support for WCLK programming comes from the High Museum of Art, presenting the last program in conjunction with Something Over Something Else, Romare Bearden's Profile series. The conversation will explore themes of journeying and movement south to north in Bearden's work with Dr. Farrah Jasmine Griffin on Saturday, January the 25th at 2 p.m. Ticket information is available at high.org.
To get up on this thing, the time is now. What you waiting for? It's time for you to get up and show the world what we have in store. Some people had to stand in line to get up in this place. Time is surely hard, pick up your guard in this crazy race. We about to get up on this thing, the time is now. What you waiting for? It's time for you to get up and show the world.
Hey, this is Jasmine Guy, and you're listening to Upfront with Ray Cornelius.
My first segment features Stephanie Hite from Atlanta's famed High Museum of Art. The author, Ann Margaret, and Terry Stint, curator of American Art, is here to chat about their current exhibition, Something Over Something Else, The Romare Bearden Profiles. Now in its final weeks, Something Over Something Else features work from the iconic artist that goes all the way back to the early 1910s through the 1940s and beyond. Check out a portion of our conversation.
Bearden was known and was doing really well in the marketplace, and people knew of him in the art world in the 70s, 60s. He really launches as an artist in the 40s. But in 1978, he was interviewed and published interviewed for the New Yorker magazine for the Profile series that they do and still do today. The title of that article, and it was written by Calvin Tompkins, who's still writing articles for The New Yorker, the title of the article was called Something Over Something Else, or actually Putting Something Over Something Else. Okay. And it was in quotes. And as it turns out, it was a quote that Bearden was cited. It was Bearden talking about the way he makes things, which is a layering process, right? And okay. It's not just relating to his collage, not just the physical, you know, I'll take a scrap of this and a scrap of that and layer it, right? Yeah. Because that is a part of it. He's putting things over. But he said making art is really bringing things together, right? It's bringing memories, ideas, concepts. It happens in painting. It happens in music. It happens across any creative process. It happens in writing. It's layering, putting something over something else. And we just thought that was the most perfect, because it's a bit of a tangled story to pull out. But in short, the reason why our exhibition is called the Profile Series is that this process that Bearden went through of talking to Calvin Tompkins for The New Yorker, thinking about his own life, his own history, his own biography, prompted him to actually create his own series of work that became his only autobiographical collection.
Okay.
And he called it Profile in honor of the New Yorker article, right, and all that, and also because it's a profile of himself. So our exhibition had to be called Profile because that was what he called it. And what we are doing is really reassembling the original group of paintings that Bearden made for this collection that was autobiographical that he called Profile in 1978.
And this is the first time that it's been together over 40 years?
It was together for about 4 weeks in a gallery in 1978. And we found all the pieces, or as many as we possibly could, and pulled them back together again. And so 78 was part one. And his idea was actually to document the decades of his life, all of them, over the course of years. So he started with the first decade. You know, he says, when I'm about six, when memory begins is when, when the project begins. Okay. He starts sort of documenting his youth as a young boy in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, which is, of course, Charlotte, North Carolina, and then a little time in Pittsburgh where he spent some time as a child. And then part two was his life as a young man in New York, in Harlem. He's got a studio over the Apollo Theater, 125th Street, and he's beginning to really realize that painting is his calling. Although he's not able to devote his time 100% to it, he has to get other jobs. He becomes a social worker. He also enlists in the army. He's in, you know, off fighting the war. All these things sort of get in the way of his work as an artist. But part two, which Biernan creates the series of part two in 1981, documents this period of his life when he's in Harlem as a young man.
Wow. Yeah. And so for you as a curator, what is the process like of putting all of this together? And again, like I said offline, I'm just imagining you in a room with all of this artwork and you're just like, okay, how do I get started?
Oh, gosh. Every exhibition is different. This one really took the cake, though. Because really what we had set out to do was to reassemble the series. And I might back up a minute and just explain why we, of all the museums out there in the world with Biernan's and their collection, why we chose to do this particular reassemblage, why we chose the Profile series. And that's because in 2014, we acquired really what I would argue is his only self-portrait, proper self-portrait, called Artist with Painting and Model. And it was in the Profile series. So a part of my job is to get curious about the kinds of things that what we own in the collection and what we have on view and do research into it. And when I learned that this was a part of a series, that's when I knew that... Well, I said to myself, wouldn't it be fun to reassemble it? I'm not sure I'd use the word fun now. Yeah. I mean, it was just a lot of work. It was really exciting, though. I mean, we found pictures all over the place. So if you can imagine, these works were initially on view in a gallery setting for sale. And so 80 to 90% of them were bought right off the walls. And off they went into private collections. And we found a few of them in museum collections, but most of them were in people's homes. And so how do you even know where they are? And so we worked with the Biernan Foundation to help track down some things. We were able to find some of the original sales records and track the the whereabouts through there. We worked with auction houses when we scoured through auction records and found one or two pieces had sold 15 years ago. So we'd write to the auction house and then they would write to the person that they had sold it to. And, you know, it was a very laborious process.
So this is not just all of this is in one area and you just all of it together. So
wouldn't that be great if there was like a Biernan store where you could go and choose?
So it's literally having to, like you said, find the owners, previous people that have owned the artwork. And then pulling all that together.
Very much so. And I mean, we had some great stories. In brief, it was a few weeks after we decided to do the show and it was all cleared and we had, the green light. And I get a phone call from the front desk of down in the museum, and there's a gentleman here who's passing through town and just wanted to talk to you about his collection. And we get calls like this on occasion, so down I go and meet this man. And as it turns out, he's en route from London to Los Angeles. Wanted to stop in to see the High Museum. Had heard great things about it. And by the way, he's looking for he has a collection of works by Romare Biernan, and would I be interested in borrowing one or two while he's in transition? Anyway, it was phenomenal because I said, "Well, wonderful. What works do you have?" And I showed him, ran up, got our checklist, and he said, "Well, I actually own that one."
Wow.
And there it was. So one out of 47, check. It was so serendipitous. That never happens, but it was amazing. And the man is absolutely delight and super generous. And so.
Wow. So we're now down to the final weeks.
Yeah.
But you guys have had various events that have been associated with the exhibition all throughout the run. You've got an event that's actually taking place on the 25th. Can we talk about that?
Absolutely. We are really thrilled to invite Dr. Farah Griffin. And she is a professor of English and literature at Columbia University, but also part of their jazz studies program there. So she's, if her name sounds familiar, It's because probably she's done a great deal of work on Billie Holiday and other jazz greats. She was just on NPR, actually, a couple months ago, honoring Billie Holiday. She was also one of a handful of distinguished scholars who was invited to participate as commentators for the Toni Morrison documentary that's out now.
Yeah.
So she's on that. I was very interested in bringing her here because of her work on Bearden. I mean, she's written about him in ways that I think are really creative. She comes at him from a music history perspective, from a literature perspective. And so her talk is actually going to be on Bearden and movement. And by that, it's really about his, in the backdrop of all these paintings in the Profile series, especially these early works that talk about his early life when his family's located in North Carolina, but he makes the move as a young child with his parents up to Harlem, and so they're participating in the Great Migration,
right,
and this transition between cultures, spaces, places, leaving family behind, and his paintings obliquely reference that kind of change and loss in a way. His memories and his connection to the South never go away. They're really prevalent throughout us. Even if he didn't actually return much after he was a child, mm-hmm. He spent many years not coming back to the South. And but yet it's always there in his work. And so Dr. Griffin is going to focus on that process of movement, transition, migration, and how that relates to Bearden. I wouldn't be surprised if there are references to jazz throughout, because, of course, that's, the world she lives in.
Yeah.
She's phenomenal.
Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for being a guest today on Upfront, Something Over Something Else, the Romare Bearden Profiles. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Is now through February the 2nd at the High Museum of Art. You can get more information about that at high.org.
This is Coleman Domingo, and you're listening to Upfront with Ray Cornelius.
My next segment features a portion of my conversation with Ed Adams from the African American Film Critics Association, AFCA. He stopped by the studio this week to chat about the Oscar nominations, the snubs, and much more. Ed Adams, welcome back to the show, and Happy New Year.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, I need to give you a corner here in the studio, because
I will take the corner.
Yeah.
Front facing, not towards the back.
Yeah.
No dunce hat, please.
Yeah, yeah. So we're actually in the thick of award show season. We've already had two award shows to commence. The Golden Globe Awards kind of kicked off 2020, as well as the Critics' Choice Awards. And then we just had the nominations announced this week for the Oscars, of which you've got, Hollywood is just all over the place right now with a lot of talk about snubs, lack of diversity. Why wasn't this actor?
Oscar's still so white.
Yeah, where were why wasn't there a female director nominated in that category? As well as Lupita Nyong'o, Jennifer Lopez, Beyonce. I was reading one of the stories, I believe it was from Rolling Stone, and they were just like, they missed it. They missed an opportunity to have Beyonce perform, at the Oscars, which would have been really good for ratings.
Disney production.
Yeah,
at the Oscars.
So if we can, let's talk about some of these snubs. And I'll start off with, Lupita Nyong'o for Us.
I was baffled by this is across the board. She's been snubbed and so many, like BAFTA. But it's good that there are some organizations that are seeing the merit of her performance. But I was really surprised that she did not get a Golden Globe nomination and she did not get an Oscar nomination for this.
She played these two different characters.
Huge oversight. But I also feel like, when movies happen earlier in the year, they tend to be forgotten and the campaigning must be stronger to kind of bring you back to those moments. Even if it's just a theatrical release again, like you got to bring it back into the conscience of the people for people to consider to vote. And I think that that's part of it. But the other part of it really is, I just think people are just not woke enough for them to understand how powerful her performance was. And I mean, just the trailer alone, she should have won an Oscar.
So here you have Little Women that received all of these nominations, but then the director, Greta Gerwig, mm-hmm. did not.
Well, she did get a nod for adapted screenplay. So I'm going to give her props for that. But okay. She should have been nominated for Best Director as well. Her adaptation of this classic story, which we've seen now, this will be the third iteration of it, is kind of unique in how it empowers women in a different way in the mind and the view for young, for people of today. It's a very more contemporary view, I should say. And it is a snub. It really is a snub, but it doesn't surprise me. I find that when we have these kind of conversations about snubs and omissions and this and that, we tend to forget that these are white people voting for white people, white men voting for white men things that white men like. And it's almost not a sin of omission quite, you know, necessarily, but it is in its own right, because you can't expect white people to think about everything all the time about everything that matters to everybody else. And they just don't. And they tell us this year after year, and we just don't seem to get it.
Dolomite is my name.
Ah.
And see, to me, that was a missed opportunity for Eddie Murphy in terms of Best Actor.
But when you say missed opportunity, what do you mean?
I mean, I thought he gave a great performance.
But when you say missed opportunity, are you saying that they could, like, they can, like, pick the apple cart back up, because they clearly knocked it over by not doing it? But are you saying that by omitting them, that they're not being woke enough? Or are you saying that, you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. what is your point by saying they miss an opportunity?
Eddie Murphy, last time he was nominated was for Dreamgirls, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't do, well, you know what? Actually,
he did miss the church.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which that kind of, yeah, that
kind of fizzled. It fizzled in box office, and he really deserved that nomination.
So there was a lot of buzz about this film. I think it won a couple of awards at some of the festivals. And so, for me, as a regular viewer, really not even a film critic, you're hearing all of this, and then you're hearing, oh, potential Oscar buzz, and then when it happens, nothing from the movie, you know, is nominated.
Right.
Wesley Snipes, his performance. Possibly could have been for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, Ruthie Carter.
Ruthie Carter for Best Costume, in which she won last year for Black Panther. And then Divine Joy, Divine Joy Randolph, I always mess up her name, for Best Supporting Actress. None of them were nominated at all. And I actually thought it was a really good film.
Yeah.
And I know there's a difference between, oh, I think the performance is great. Every performance that is good is not also an Oscar-worthy performance. So I get that part.
But one of the things I find interesting, and this is, there hasn't been very many comedies mm-hmm. that have been in Best Picture, and similarly for Best Actor, Actress Supporting, and other. So I agree with you. I think it's a misstep, because they as a whole, the voting body doesn't consider comedy in the role of Best Picture, because what they really should be saying is Best Picture Drama, the same way that Critics' Choice and Golden Globes does.
But do you consider that film a comedy?
Well, it's comedic. I don't necessarily think about it quite the same as a comedy, but it's comedic in its own right. I mean, there are some pretty funny moments in it. The way that it's written, Eddie's portrayal, Rudy Ray Moore, his caricature of him, I think is actually more on the comedic side than dramatic. But I would think that if they wanted to classify it or to defend their stance on it, they would say, well, it's really a comedy. And they would just like, well, we're looking at more serious, more, you know, in-depth roles, like running through, you know, Germany during 1917 or something like that. But,
Just Mercy.
Big misstep for them personally, for Jamie Foxx. I think that Jamie Foxx gave an amazing performance in this film.
And I thought Rob Moore gave an amazing performance.
Incredible.
Best supporting actor.
Rob
Morgan, I'm sorry. I said Moore. Rob Morgan.
Yeah. His performance was so jarring to watch that it kind of moved me in a way that this film has a lot of missteps personally to me. But, you know, to separate the film from the performances, yeah, Rob Morgan was amazing and incredible. Like, his performances stay with you well after the film. And it drives the message of why we need, you know, criminal justice reform so much today. I guess we've always needed it, but yeah.
So then how can we, I guess, as creatives, Black Hollywood, how can we move forward understanding that this may not change? You know, despite
it's not going to change
the campaigning, the marketing efforts, the adding of you know, more, you know, people of color to the membership. How can we move this forward?
Well, I mean, we need to stop this "stop being white" campaign that we tend to do every year. Like, you know, when these nominations come out, it's like Oscar's so white and, you know, they're not woke enough. And, you know, the Me Too moments. I mean, they're all relevant and they don't speak towards these truths. But you're not going to expect this organization to change. I think that we need to start investing in our own enterprises, the organizations, the festivals, and the award shows that speak to the things that revere our culture, like the AFCA Awards and like the NAACP Image Awards and the TV One
Urban One
Awards.
Honors, yeah.
Yeah, like we need to be investing in that more so than trying to sit at that table as we constantly continue to do. I think it's kind of a moot point at this point to keep saying, when are they going to learn? We're people too. They're like, we don't really care.
So Ed, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media and keep up with all of the exciting things that are happening in New York?
I'm an avid Twitterer. So I will say, just follow me on The Ed at Large on Twitter.
What's happening? This is Aldis Hodge, star of Showtime's City on the Hill, and you're listening to Upfront with Ray Cornelius on WCOK 91.9, Atlanta's jazz station.
When you wake up, you don't know that today will be the day to change your life.
Grace, please tell me what happened. What did he do to you?
I was falling hard. I didn't even know that a man could be that perfect.
You married me.
It was a whirlwind. It was the happiest time of my life. That's when everything I knew shattered.
That was a snippet from the trailer of Tyler Perry's new dramatic thriller, A Fall from Grace. The Netflix movie features Crystal Fox as Grace Waters, a new divorcee whose faith in love is restored by a budding romance. But when secrets surface about her new husband, her vulnerable side turns violent. I got a chance to chat with Tyler Perry and Crystal Fox, as well as her co-stars Bresha Webb and Felicia Rashad, at Tyler Perry Studios to chat about the film and much more.
Congratulations, everybody.
Thank you, Ray.
We were yelling at the screen. You had us on the edge of our seats. I was calling you Barney Miller, the mean Barney Miller.
Good. That's good.
This is your first Netflix project. So how did that relationship all get started for you?
Well, I had shot the movie and it was in the can and Netflix wanted to see it. So I showed it to them and I thought, what a great opportunity that everybody in the world will get a chance to see my movie at once. Because I've never had a movie open internationally other than Why Did I Get Married, I think. And maybe it was for Color Girls. But it was much later on after the movie had opened here. So this is the first time everybody can go home, turn on television, and watch it all around the world. So I'm excited about that.
Wow. Yeah. Let's talk about the inspiration behind this. Because we always hear that you have these characters in your head. And I'm just like, Lord, help Tyler with all these folks in his head.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I just wanted to do this story that I've done many times. Boy meets girl. You know, girl gets her heart broke. She wants revenge. But as I was writing it, I had just seen a documentary called Gideon's Army about the Public Defender's Office, and I was thinking about the state of the criminal justice system, as well as something was on the news about this duo and what they were doing. I was like, whoa. Mm-hmm. And it all kind of found its way into the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crystal, congratulations. This is your first leading role in a film.
Yes.
Very, long time coming, and
yes,
we've been so excited for you. What was it about this particular character in the script that you were just like, absolutely, I got to do this?
Well, first of all, anytime Tyler's asked me, do you want to do this?
Yeah.
It's like, yes, because I know he sees me in it. And if he sees me, I know I get to sink my teeth into something the way I'd like to. And this was no different, except for the fact that I would have the lead. I think somewhere I kind of put that in the back of my mind, like, that's not really happening, that's not really happening. And just But I committed to delving into this woman's life and telling the story for people, as I usually choose to do anyway. Yeah. And first of all, thank you for always seeing us. Always and shining light on us. I just have to say that too. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you. Thank you. What was it? Oh, let me go back. Was working with Tyler any different this time around than in times past with Have and Have Nots? Was was there any difference, or was it the same experience?
Well, he scared me to death because I was like, okay, don't think of it being any differently, because the sense of responsibility for a film, I just kept thinking, I was putting pressure on myself. And I was fine, and I was coming to work, and I was thinking, I'll just approach it like I do with Tyler. And then he said, I'm different on a film. I'm more focused. Or no, he said, I'm different on a film. And he said, just be ready. And that was like, that. I was like, I'm not ready now. Now that you said that. But no, to me, he's just as focused. And I just, I decided to do and approach it the same way I did for Have and Have Nots. So, yeah. He's the same.
Yeah. Brecia Webb. Man, Jasmine, we loved her. We were cheering for you. We were kind of like, man, he's so mean.
You're like, Tyra, we were rooting for you.
Yeah, I was just like, man, he sucks as a boss. How was it playing Jasmine, and what did you enjoy, you know, about playing?
Just showing playing something different to an audience that loves me for my comedy.
Yeah.
I was so excited to show something different and to prove something to myself that I can do it. You know, being theatrically trained, you know, it's never, I can't say for everyone, but some women of color, we get pigeonholed into these little boxes of what we are as artists. Yeah. And so I was so thankful that Tyler saw me as a dramatic actress as well. I was in a small part in Acrimony, and he saw me and he thought of me and texted me to read the script. I was honored when he said I could play Jasmine. I thought he texted the wrong person, you know, and to work with the masters of the craft, seriously, to work, you know, with Queen Cicely Tyson. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could never imagine my life to be already where it is right now. So I'm just honored and living in the moment. Pinch me, please. The work that I did before, I'm just so happy that it comes full circle now.
And Tyler, I'm glad that you cast her in this as well as Acrimony, because she's very funny, but it's also great to see you in these dramatic roles, the emotion. I didn't see it as, okay, she's going to laugh after this.
Yeah.
It was really, I really believed you.
Thank you.
Miss Rashad, man, we were almost like, whoa. And then there were some scenes where it was like, you better not hit Claire. But we really, really enjoyed you in this role, which is kind of a, I don't want to give too much away, but it's somewhat a little different from what you've played in the past. What did you enjoy about playing Sarah?
The subtleties.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Subtleties of expression.
And there was a lot of black girl magic. So what was it working together?
Now, we can't give that away, what the magic is. But yeah, there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
It was powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is always powerful when women come together and really work together. The world must stand back when that happens.
That is the absolute truth.
Yeah. Tyler, you tend to cast a lot of the same actresses. What is it about working with the same people?
I love good people. And when I find good people, I want to keep them around me. I love working with people who have amazing work ethics, who take their gifts and they appreciate them and they hone them and they make them even more amazing. So, yeah, I love that. But I love giving new faces a chance as well, like giving Crystal her first leading role. I mean, this is, and flipping Brecia on her head here, making her, putting her into these dramatic roles. So it's, I love it on all those levels.
This was shot in 5 days?
Yeah.
Yes.
Why so fast?
Scheduling, timing, and also just I didn't come up in the Hollywood system in the way that they do things. And what I notice on a lot of films, I don't care how big or small the budget is, there's a lot of downtime and a lot of waste. And it drives me nuts when I'm on other people's set and I know that they're shooting amazing stuff, but the waste budget is higher than the actual budget of the show. So I just, and you have to understand too that I'm not just the writer, the director, but I'm also the producer who's usually watching the money. So all of that matters.
Yeah. If we can I get from each of you a takeaway message that you want the audiences to walk away with from this film? There were a lot of twists and turns. I don't want to give those away, but just a takeaway message for this film, A Fall from Grace.
For me, it's just take the ride. It's a thriller. Just let it be what it is. It's entertainment. It's going to thrill you. If it speaks to you in some way and you get a message from it, I hope that it's something that encourages you. But it's a thriller. Let it be that.
Anyone else?
Stay open to love. Nothing's wrong with that. But stay open to your calling, your discernment, and be careful for be careful of predators.
Yeah.
Fight. Keep fighting, even when your back is up against the wall.
Absolutely.
And you're locked up.
Yeah. And Ms. Rashad, anything you'd like
what
to say?
What he said.
Yeah.
Throw the groceries.
Well, thank you all so very much.
Thank
A Fall
you.
From Grace is on Netflix today.
Yes.
So we're really, really excited. Thank we you. Should have a party tonight.
Hello.
At my house.
Be awesome.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Watch the full interview with Tyler Perry and his cast at WCLK.com. Well, that'll do it for this week's show. I'd like to thank all of my special guests, Stephanie Height, Edward Adams, Tyler Perry, Felicia Rashad, Brisha Webb, and Crystal Fox. I'd also like to thank my engineer, Jami Wellman, and you. Please tune in next week for another exciting edition of Upfront, Inside Atlanta's Entertainment Industry. Happy Saturday, Atlanta. If you like today's show, please hit us up at WCLK.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Upfront, Inside Atlanta's Entertainment Industry has been brought to you by Atlanta's Jazz Station 91.9 FM WCLK, an NPR member-supported station.